Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a tribute event to Ursula K. Le Guin that took place on June 13, 2018 at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland. We're rebroadcasting this episode on the one-year anniversary of her passing. Le Guin's legacy is broad and deep, and it will last for generations. We have lost one of the greatest American writers, a pioneering voice for women, and a fearless defender of free speech. As a writer, she redefined entire genres while publishing in nearly all of them during a career that lasted for more than a half century. As a female artist, she broke ground and made new spaces for other brilliant writers to publish and have an audience, writers who had been marginalized because of their gender, race, or chosen genre. As an activist, she spoke up for artists and free speech. She was never afraid to speak her mind, and we were all the better for it. She was a tireless artist, friend, and citizen. Until she passed away on January 22nd at the age of 88, Le Guin remained engaged with her community at both a national and a local level. It's a tremendous honor for Literary Arts to have been asked by the Le Guin family to host this event. Ursula K. Le Guin was involved with our organization for 31 years, helping shape our programs for readers and writers as a participant, a trusted advisor, and a supporter. On this episode, we'll hear from artists influenced by her work, readers who were changed by her stories, and some of her closest friends. This episode is an excerpt of a much longer event. If you want to watch the video, go to www.literary-arts-tribute.org. Here's writer Molly Gloss.
I've only once ever taken a writing workshop. 10 weeks, one night a week. It was winter term 1981 at Portland State, then it was a college. Ursula was my teacher. I want to tell you what that was like. I was 36 years old, a suburban housewife. I had a 7-year-old son, a blue-collar husband. I was a novice writer, just at the start of taking my writing seriously. I knew nobody else who was writing. Nobody. I had written 2 short stories. They were the first stories I had ever finished. One of them was a science fiction. I'd come to reading science fiction late in my 30s. I'd been making my way through a list of recommended titles I had from the library. Le Guin was just one name on that list. The recommended book was Left Hand of Darkness. Slow beginning, that book. I was 2 chapters in and I still wasn't really caught up by it. I borrowed it from the library. The due date was coming fast. I almost took the book back without finishing it. When I think of my life as a writer, what if I hadn't kept reading? But I did. It was the first time in years that a book had made me cry. I went back to the library for Le Guin. I brought home The Dispossessed, which almost made me think I should just give up trying to write at all. What would be the point? I would never be that good. But the next Le Guin I tried was one of the very early ones, maybe her first science fiction, a short little novel, Rokanen's World, I'm pretty sure it was. And I thought, oh, she started somewhere. She hadn't just come out of the gate with Left Hand and Dispossessed. I could aspire to someday write a book as good as Rokanen. By the fall of 1980, I had read everything of Le Guin's, and then I heard by chance about this science fiction writing workshop at Portland State. Lots of people wanted in, so you had to submit a story to pass muster. I had that one science fiction story. Something else I've thought about, how my life would be different if I'd never heard about that workshop or had not written a story that could get me in. The room we met in was an ordinary school classroom, the kind with student desks arranged in rows and the teacher's desk at the front of the room. My very first glimpse of Ursula, she was poking her head into the room and frowning. She and Tony Walk, who was from the English department at Portland State, who was her co-teacher. They soon had us shoving these desks around to try to make a circle, but the room was not really big enough for 22 desks in a circle. Well, one of us, her name was Sarah Gogol, happened to work in Kramer Hall, and she had the key to an office where there was room enough if we sat in a circle on the carpeted floor. Ursula moved us over there without asking anybody's permission. We all thought that was bold, but of course it was only Ursula. I think maybe we all worry a bit meeting a famous writer in real life, someone whose work we've admired. We don't want to find out that they're arrogant. But I think in Ursula's case, for a lot of us, it's more that idolatry can come very close to intersecting with terror. But that first day of class, meeting her that first time, she looked, sounded, acted exactly as her written work had led me, has led all of us to hope. She was wicked smart, completely sane, and deeply kind. She was shy or maybe introverted. Are those the same thing? I'm not sure, but she was also a great big ham. She had strong opinions. She was not an arrogant. She was funny, so funny, and she snorted when she laughed. Not white hair yet, but graying, I think. She would have been just 50. The format for the workshop, what she called the Milford method, you can Google that, is common in peer critique now, but it was new to me then. In the one creative writing class that I had taken at Portland State, an instructor had lectured us from the front of the room, took our papers away, and brought them back marked up with red ink. In the Milford method, Ursula's method, no lectures. We were peers. And we went around one at a time talking about the story that we had all read ahead of time, what parts of the story we liked best, places where we were surprised or annoyed or confused. Ursula always spoke last. She didn't want to influence anyone else's comments. And I learned everything I know about critique, everything, by listening to her do it. She always considered what a story was about, what the writer was trying to do, and then she tried to help the writer get there without making it into her story. The level of her comments always matched the level of the writing. If it was a strong story from a skillful writer, she could drill down, she would drill down, even to a single word or the smallest wobbles of tone or syntax. A story with lots of problems and a writer still a novice, Ursula could always find at least one really good thing in it. Maybe only a phrase or a sentence or a simile. And she would say why it impressed her. Here's a really fine sentence and here is why, she would say. And then she would use that fine sentence or phrase or simile to make some larger point, illustrate something about the craft of writing. And then she would zero in on just one problem in the story, one among the many. She would suggest maybe a point of view change, a paragraph dropped so to end the story sooner, or maybe moving a scene around to a different spot in the story. And we would all see right away, oh, this one change would immediately make the story better. Not fix it, not entirely, but lift it up a great big notch. She was never cruel, but she could be emphatic. She had told us when our own story was up for discussion, don't explain, don't defend. One time, a writer couldn't keep from arguing with us all. She said she had written the story that she wanted to write, and that what we were all telling her about the problems we had with the story didn't really make any difference to her. And she went on like this, explaining and defending, and Ursula grew fairly annoyed. She said it sounded to her as if this writer trusted only her own judgment and was writing to please only herself, which she said was perfectly fine, perfectly okay. But it's a bit like singing in the shower, she said. And if you're going to sing in the shower, then you really shouldn't be asking all these hardworking critics, and she swung her hand out, meaning all of us, to spend their time making a serious music review. I remember the writer didn't come back the next week. Ursula and I would become friends. We were friends for 35 years. Over those years, we were in several critique groups together, prose and poetry both, peer groups. Although I think the people in this auditorium all know that Ursula has no peers, and I'm pretty sure she never really needed our input. But I know she enjoyed the process. Most of those groups were formed at her instigation. In the Milford method, Ursula's method, there is an absolute rule that while discussion is going around the room, the writer of the story or the poem has to keep silent. Only after everyone else has had their say can the writer speak. But in recent years in our poetry group, she sometimes couldn't keep from breaking her own rule. And when or if one of us could work up the nerve to call her on it, she would clap her hand over her mouth to quiet whatever she was in the middle of saying and to smother her laugh, that little snort of a laugh, which is only one of the many things I will miss. Thank you.
Here's writer Jonathan Lethem.
If you live long enough, I think you're destined to feel that your life is a bridge in time. I've begun to experience this sensation myself, and I'm only in my 50s. This can take a generic form, as when, say, you understand that your parent or grandparent recalls a time before telephones or television. Or in my personal instance, when I learned my father had seen Charlie Parker play in a small nightclub in Kansas City. Or as my grandchildren may be amazed to learn, should I live long enough, that I spoke at Ursula Le Guin's memorial. In the inner life of a person, this bridging sensation can be much less simple to name. A form of incommensurable knowing that one has lived to feel a variety of different versions of what it means to be human, to feel them pass beside and also through you, and to have to learn to abide with that incommensurability. For many people, this may be a difficult sensation to navigate, let alone to name. Many can only protest at its dispossessing force. A small number of people, and in my own experience, Ursula was foremost among them, are those whose bridging capacity seems not thrust on them by the depredations of time, but rather something innate, embraced, a thing taken perhaps even at a young age and expanded upon as a gift and forming a bridge greatly transcending their own lifespan. While on the one hand, Ursula would always be the first to remind you that she wasn't born early enough to experience her father's period of involvement with the man known as Ishi, the so-called last of his tribe, she seemed in some way to embrace and embody ancient curiosity and contemplation within her person. And then, as we all know, to project them splendidly into future human possibilities, into that form of delicately political dreaming known as utopia. To put it more simply, Ursula lived in a present that encompassed the past and the future, more of it than seemed possible. And in every gesture in her work, she seemed capable of gently welcoming you into that embodiment. A few even simpler descriptions and a quick anecdote before I join the rest of you as listeners. When I was attempting to enter the science fiction field, I was a troubled young man in many ways. I wanted to enter the field but not share in its stigma. The model that Ursula offered, the dignity and clarity of her bridging work between those exiles working in the fantastic tradition in the United States and the literary establishment was the most dignified and appealing possible. When she reached out individually to me, as she did with so many other younger writers, it was as if I'd been allowed to borrow her dignity against my own impoverished share. I was also full of political rage and political absolutism. I was pretty sure the only kind of writing that could represent the discordant, resistant sensation in me was dystopian. In the 60s, the science fiction field had split into two camps, signed two petitions published in the magazines, one for and one against the American war in Vietnam. This is really, as Yogi Berra says, you could look it up. The technotopians, the space race writers, were on the whole in favor of our participation in the war, and the neurotic, paranoiac dystopians were mostly signatories against it. I knew which team I was on. As silly as it may seem, when I discovered the existence of those two petitions, I conducted a political purge against my own teenage bookshelves. To put it unattractively, I took names. I spent a couple of glamorous occasions with Ursula, or at least they seemed glamorous to me. Once at a long table in the garden of the California country house she and Charles kept. I believe it had been her parents. I was the youngest at a table of invited writers, but we were all there as if in some enchanted Ingmar Bergman film, one of the happy ones, under the grace of Ursula and Charles' hospitality. Another evening, she and I shared a stage at the New School for Social Research in Manhattan. But the visit that stays with me most is the least glamorous. I can't remember how it came about, but she and I, and I believe Karen Joy Fowler, ate dinner at a pedestrian Thai restaurant in Berkeley one night with Paul and Karen Anderson. The Andersons were science fiction royalty, but they were also the two top signatories, thanks to their place in the alphabet, of the pro-Vietnam War petition. And I held myself apart from them. They were on the wrong team. I warned you this was an unattractive story for me personally. While Karen Anderson seemed oblivious to my aloofness, Paul was a shy and sensitive man. He was also a deeply erudite man, knowledgeable in history and myth. And Ursula not only delved deep into conversation with him, she drew me in, insisted, without shaming me, that I participate. This was bridge work of an intimate variety. This was a utopian operation, a local utopia, or what the anarchists sometimes like to call a temporary autonomous zone. The reason I'm willing to air out this tiny embarrassment and my own paltry epiphany that Paul Anderson was more than worth my time, he might have a lot to teach me. The reason I'm in your presence tonight is simply that I want to say that for all the vastness of her spirit and imagination and utopian desire tempered as it must be by a deep, vigilant knowledge of dystopia, Ursula didn't only elaborate her bridges in the air. She elaborated them in the space between people. An appetite for utopia and a knowledge of what it might take to even reach for something other than that which we see before us entered the room with Ursula Le Guin everywhere she walked. Thank you.
Here's writer and editor Kelly Link.
It's an extraordinary thing to be here to celebrate Ursula K. Le Guin tonight with all of you here in the audience and with all of you all over the world who are watching the live stream. This is the second time in the last 5 years that I've been in the company of people who have come together to honor her. The first time was in 2014. In New York, when she received the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters, she gave an electric speech, a barn burner. She asked the publishing world to consider the value of art and literature above the profit motive. She asked the publishing world to be better than it is. She spoke of the power of literature to resist, to open doors. She thanked the National Book Foundation for the beautiful reward. She said, "We who live by writing and publishing want and should demand our fair share of the proceeds. But the name of our beautiful reward isn't profit. Its name is freedom." I know that at the time, she wasn't entirely pleased to have to leave Portland and travel to New York to receive her medal. She was tired of travel. But at the National Book Awards ceremony, she was radiantly pleased to be honored, to be listened to be recognized for the work of her life. She knew her own worth. Roger Angel, speaking about his stepfather E.B. White at White's memorial, said, "If Andy White could be with us today, he would not be with us today." But I can't help imagining how pleased Ursula would be, again, here in this moment, could she be here to see all of you. As a writer and a builder of communities of writers, Le Guin is at the heart of the canon of books that I love best. We all have personal canons. Le Guin is bedrock to many of us. She had an unmatched appetite and capacity for imagining how the world could be different, and how, if the world was different, the people who lived there might be different too. Earthsea, Arsenia, Gethin, all the worlds of the Hainish cycle, Klatsund, Oregon. Her fiction, her point of view offered, still offers, will always offer, a vision of community to those who are far from it. The scope of Le Guin's vision allowed room for hope, for evil, for grief, for resistance, for change. In person, she was earthy, profound, plain-speaking, impatient with foolishness, but appreciative of gossip and wordplay. She could have been a character in a story by Chaucer if Chaucer had written stories about Portland or science fiction conventions. She would have been a remarkable politician or psychologist or map maker, or magician, but of course, because she was a writer, she was all of these and more. She wrote terrifying, witty dragons of unearthly beauty because she was herself a terrifying, witty, and beautiful dragon, the most dragonish person I've ever met. My husband and I run a small press, and in 2009, we had been corresponding with Le Guin about publishing a two-volume collection of her short stories. At the time, I was pregnant, and then I was on bed rest, and then I gave birth to a daughter at 24 weeks. My husband and I had not yet spent much time thinking about names. When we had to come up with one on the spur of the moment, we named her Ursula Annabel Link Grant. When Gavin emailed Le Guin to apologize for having been out of touch while our Ursula was in the NICU and to tell her the name we'd chosen, Le Guin responded, "Ursula Annabel Link Grant is two dactyls followed by a spondy. I like it." Over the course of a decade, we published four books with Le Guin, her translation of the Argentinian writer Angelica Gorodischer, a two-volume selection of her short stories, and a collection of nonfiction. We sometimes had to pinch ourselves to believe our good fortune, and I think if we had ever said that to Le Guin, she would have offered to pinch us hard. I know, too, that many of the writers that we've published, Sophia Samatar, Larry Marks, Karen Joy Fowler, Vandana Singh, Ted Chiang, like me, were profoundly inspired by Le Guin's writing. but then it's hard to think of writers or people who love books that she did not touch. I know that some of you gathered here in the audience or elsewhere in the world, watching those of us on stage who have been given the chance to talk about Le Guin, formidable, far-sighted, foundational, fire-breathing Le Guin, have your own stories about her. She was a generous correspondent and reader and teacher and friend. I imagine that after tonight is over and done with, we will go on telling stories about her and hearing stories about her and writing stories and books that we would not have thought to write if she had not made such an expansive and inviting an idea engendering space for us to inhabit as writers and artists. I know that we will go on revisiting the landscapes and characters and concepts and books that only exist because she saw them in her dragonish mind and breathed life into them. Earth, sea, Orsinia, Gethin, all the worlds of the Hainish cycle, Klatsen, Oregon.
Here's Ursula's editor, Andrea Schulz.
It's a tremendous honor to be speaking here today. It's also a complicated charge to be the voice of corporate America at a Le Guin tribute. I think really the only way to honor her is to try to live up to her model of fearless truth-telling and forge ahead. Like many of us, I first encountered her as a young reader who was looking for other worlds. But she came into my professional life 12 years ago with an email, fittingly, as that was how our relationship primarily unfolded. Author and editor Michael Kandel had brought Ursula to Harcourt and worked with an in-house editor on the last two Earthsea books and on Changing Planes. She then published the Annals of the Western Shore trilogy with our children's division, losing touch with the adult side when the in-house editor Jen Sherratt left. Then I arrived, and in 2006, Michael reached out. Might there be someone who would want to read the adult novel that Ursula had just finished? Publishing depends more on luck and timing than anyone is willing to admit, and it was luck, really, that brought me Ursula. Of course, that situation, an editor gone, a new one who may or may not be sympathetic to your work, was not necessarily lucky for her always, and I think it sheds some light on her sometimes wary relationships with publishers. She had great editors and champions, to be sure. Many houses, small and large, have published her with distinction for decades. But when I look at the Library of America chronology of her work, which I highly recommend, they've done an amazing job, alongside the accolades and awards, I also see a writer who again and again had to start over with new editors and hope that each one was the person who could weave that delicate web of support, of excitement, of institutional commitment that a book must have to succeed and to flourish for years. It's a lot of extra work, and it would have taken a lot of luck for it to always go right. That history made it all the more remarkable to me that she greeted my excited introductory email, one of God only knows how many in her career, with the optimism and the warmth that she brought to our whole relationship. She said, "If I told you the book was based on, or derived from, or playing around with Virgil's Aeneid, would that sound very depressing?" I reassured her that nothing that she could send would depress me, and a few weeks later, I received the novel in a manuscript box. I was awestruck as I opened it, just on principle, frankly. But as I started to read it, I felt my hair actually stand a little bit on end. The mastery on those pages was like nothing I had experienced before and will probably never experience again. Lavinia, who is given not a word to speak in the Aeneid, speaks from the mythical past from her very first line in that manuscript. I found out much later that Ursula had relearned Latin and made her way through the Aeneid 10 lines a day to prepare to write it. It was her 21st novel, and it would be her last. Every writer is different in how they respond to edits, and I have worked with some brilliant writers who nod quite seriously as I talk about this or that and then completely ignore me. And I wouldn't have blamed her for doing the same thing, but Ursula solicited my thoughts from the very beginning and welcomed a conversation. She was deeply engaged, it will not surprise you, with every issue I raised, however small or large. She responded to my query about water spirits with a long explanation about the sacred in the early Roman world, while linking it to Shinto and the rituals of the Pueblo people in a casual parenthetical. She answered another query about the rules of the book's universe with, "Good question, must think about this," which, frankly, is a line that is the pinnacle of my editorial career. We went back and forth electronically like this for a month, trading responses in different colored fonts. At some point in every edit, your notes stop helping the author to make their book what they want it to be, and start creeping into the territory of what might have been a great idea if they had written a different book altogether. Ursula recognized that moment instantly and stopped my trampling of her garden with great good humor, although with also the sharp clarity that I suspect had protected her vision from the diluting effect of her many collaborators over the years. As Michael Kandel said, she has an open mind, but she also knows her mind. Ursula's rousing critique of publishers and the book industry, which I was also lucky enough to hear, was truly a barn burner. You'll see a little bit of it later, and if you haven't seen the whole thing, I recommend it. And for all the pleasures of our editorial collaboration, I also knew that in some ways, to publish her at a big commercial house was always to fail her. Packaging, promoting, marketing a work, it's a necessity, and it can be an art form in itself, but it is also a reduction, and publishing categorizes relentlessly. Covers were always particularly tricky. They distill an era's prejudice about race, gender, genre, so you can imagine the dissonance for a writer whose whole life and work fought every one of those simplifications. Covers need to say something to a reader at first glance. Again, that sort of compression and simplification is the inverse of her art. For years, she battled to have her characters represented as dark-skinned, as she'd written them. And I would argue that her books weren't always envisioned as innovatively as they could have been, also just simply because she was a woman, not to mention a genre writer. She fought for her work herself, of course. One of the many email exchanges we had about the Earthsea backlist came with the subject line, "The old cow kicks up." And her insistence that the labels failed not only her work, but also failed readers, is what brought us to this place where the labels have been transcended, both for her books and for so many writers who were able to disregard them because of her example. Publishing has responded too. One of my great accomplishments in our 8 years of working together was to helping build a bridge between Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and Simon & Schuster so that Earthsea books could be published as a united whole, an unusual corporate partnership which is, I am delighted to see, is continuing with the SNS edition of the illustrated Earthsea coming later this year. Exactly. The art is out in the lobby and you really must look at it. Lavinia might have been, in retrospect, the last of her books to appear before our world fully became what she had helped to make it and finally saw her work as she had insisted that it should be seen all along. The thrill of getting an email from her was fresh every time, and she was one of the great correspondents. She wrote me a delightful note about feeding chickens when she returned from a trip to her ranch once. "When I got too close, the bantam rooster would advance menacingly and stiffen his wattles and make horrible noises, and then he'd assault my ankle, so I'd kick dust at him, which made him so furious, all he could do was stand there all puffed out, shouting bad words at me like a tiny little Republican on Fox TV." Another favorite came when she was doing an appearance with Margaret Atwood. "If you could ask Margaret a question, what would it be? She says we should talk about what is fiction, what is science fiction, and is the human race doomed?" But I'm looking for a few lesser questions in case we exhaust fiction and doom. In 2010, when she sent in the poetry collection that would become Finding My Elegy, she wrote, "Started with poetry and apparently going to end with it." And when I became another one of her editors who left her in my move to Viking, we finished as we had begun with an email, this one painfully, characteristically generous in her good wishes for me. In one of the many tributes this January, Laura Miller wrote, "Part of Le Guin's greatness lay in her ability to crack open the shells we didn't even realize had confined us." Publishing may never be equal to the sheer vastness and variety of her talent, but she left us with everything we need to crack our shell.
Here's author and activist Walida Imarisha.
I'm so honored to be here tonight to celebrate the many gifts that Ursula K. Le Guin has left all of us with. I did not know her personally. I just want to be honest. I met her once, and I'm sure she wouldn't have remembered my fangirl moment, because I think I didn't embarrass myself too badly. But I carry that meeting with me. But I have also been connected with Ursula the majority of my life through her work, both her writing and the work she did to create change and community. I was a student of hers, like countless of us, without her knowing my name or my face. Much of what I do now is around the very modest goal of changing the world. I see science fiction or visionary fiction as integral to that. Visionary fiction is about science fiction and social change together, recognizing we need imaginative spaces like sci-fi if we are going to build new just futures. We have to have space to dream the change we will build. And of course, I learned so much of this through Ursula's writings. And I also learned it from seeing how Ursula moved in the world, seeing her remain accessible to young writers, organizers, community groups, even as there was more and more demands on her time. She worked both to create space to dream and to support building those dreams into existence. Ursula once said, "I think hard times are coming when we will want the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now and can see through our fear-stricken society and its obsessive technologies to other ways of being and even imagine some real grounds for hope. We will need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, the realists of a larger reality. It is the truth-telling and the dreaming Ursula speaks of together that is so powerful and so subversive. We must be honest about the hard times that are coming, that are already here, that have been here. We cannot allow oppression to ever be rationalized away. But this is not all there is. This is not all we are. We can transcend the smaller reality for the larger reality Ursula spoke of. It is just waiting for us to build a path for it to enter this world. But to do so, we have to have principles, we have to have integrity, and we cannot compromise those, not even for a nanosecond. I learned that from Ursula as well. The radical politics in her work were always front and center. She did not attempt to hide it, dress it up so that it might pass unnoticed by those with power. She put her politics on display proudly. This is an invaluable gift she has left us. She has shown us how to write beautifully, deftly, eloquently, while also writing without compromise. Writers are so often pressured to be accessible rather than visionary. If they have radical politics, they are told at best to hide them and at worst to hit the delete key. Ursula was having none of that. Ursula was always clear about institutional power inequalities. She was always clear about which side she stood on, and she was clear that we humans could dream our way out of almost anything. And Ursula taught me to interrogate my dreams as well, to take responsibility for my dreams, to question my idea of perfection, utopia. What am I fighting for? Octavia Butler once said she found the idea of utopias boring. What I learned from Ursula is that the idea of uninterrogated utopia is also dangerous, because utopias are too often built on the marginalized, the silenced, the oppressed, as she illustrated so powerfully in her story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. The day a society accepts the pain of even one as a necessary evil is the day humanity dies. As someone involved in community organizing, I return to Ursula's book, The Dispossessed, again and again and again and again. The very subtitle sums it up, an ambiguous utopia. The fact that this anarchist society had become complacent and self-satisfied, thinking they had achieved the perfect society, and that this became the very thing that moved them further away from the values and ideals they held. It is through the constant questioning of ourselves, our communities, our societies, that we move towards our best selves. Ursula's portrayal of the anarchist society enriches the complexities, the nuances, the beauty, and the flaws. She presents it lovingly, but honestly. She loves Inaris too much to lie, because she truly believes in Inaris's capacity to change. The book ends not with disillusion, but with hope. But The Dispossessed doesn't have any neatly packaged ending, and neither do most of Ursula's works. There are no simple answers, and the complex, messy answers we do find in the stories are not handed to us. We have to discover them ourselves. If we ever find a neat ending in life, it is probably a lie. Just as the best books do not end, but allow us to imagine beyond that last page. Revolutions do not end because there are always new ideas to be sought, new concepts of justice to be centered. Often, when I say there is no end to struggle, there's no end to the work of social change, folks hear it in the voice of doom. There will be no end to the work you must do. I don't say it like that. But I learned through Ursula's writings that the responsibility of the writer, of the dreamer, of the change maker, does not have to feel heavy or tedious. Holding the future of the human race is a serious business, but we can still find ways to laugh along the way. And Ursula's work shows that eternal cycles of change mean we have infinite possibilities to reaffirm, to be excited by something unknown, to find new joys, to discover and rediscover collective truths. In that way, Ursula is such a generous writer. She creates stories that challenge us to imagine ourselves in them, to think about the complex choices and possibilities, and once the book is done, she leaves space for us to take what we need. She allows us to live with her stories, to have them whisper to us and become part of our dreams. Her stories help us to both remember freedom and dream freedom, and they help us to turn those dreams into all of our larger lived reality. I am so incredibly and eternally thankful that Ursula will always be part of my dreams of freedom. Thank you.
Here's writer Daniel Jose Older.
Thank you.
What a tremendous honor. I'm also just so happy that we can gather together, this many of us, to celebrate a warrior, a story master, in a time that's so difficult and so painful for so many people. Each one of you is a light for coming out tonight, for watching on the live stream, for joining us to mark this occasion. When you are a newly hatched baby writer, which I may or may not still be, depending on who you ask and which version of writer years we're going by, dog or cat, you look out into the world wondering where and whether you and your stories belong in it. Who fits into your personal pantheon of patron saints? Whose solemn or smiling stained glass faces you'd like your own to be enshrined beside when you go? Who is telling a semblance of the truth about the world as you know it? And what you find out very often is that so many writers have been lying to us all along, squeezing what you know are complicated truths, delicious, ambiguous realities about life into very easily digestible, tasteless little pills. Simple, inoffensive, comfortable, dead. And then you find and surreptitiously borrow your sister's tattered copy of A Wizard of Earthsea, which I may or may not have done and may or may not still have on the third shelf of my bookcase next to Octavia Butler's Wild Seed. Please don't tell her. I think she's looking for it. Anyway, you find it and you open it and allow yourself to become first immersed and then utterly lost in those pages, in that world.
In the depths and complexity of it, its refusal to accommodate easy answers, its lumbering, brisk beauty and unstoppable directness, where so many fantasies for so long gave us heroes that were both appallingly, flatly good and overwhelmingly white, white, white. Collectively, driving home the most unsubtlest of points, Ursula K. Le Guin gave us Ged, a fully fleshed out human who was blatantly, unambiguously dark-skinned, and it was simply a truth, not a plot point. Ged's skin color mattered enough to her that she went out of her way to be ahead of the curve, publicly slamming the television adaptation of Earthsea for whitewashing him, a loud voice in a silent white sea. And where so many fantasies for so long have driven the already unsubtle point even further home and urged us to look outward and destroy that snarling, non-white coated other, Earthsea, and I apologize for the spoiler, but really it's your own fault if you haven't read it. Earthsea asked that we look inside ourselves, confront that shadow within that causes disconnect and disaster when left unaddressed, and rather than simply annihilate it, it asked that we allow it back in to become a part of us once again, to find a sense of whole with it, and in a word, balance. If there is a word for the opposite of condescending, and I don't think there really is one that fully encompasses it, that is what Ursula Le Guin imbued her work with, no matter what age she was writing for. Rather than talk down to us, she demanded, with love and laughter and some sternness, that we step up our game and rise to the occasion. She was able to ask this without seeming overbearing, quite simply because, by some magic, she knew we had it in us. And she was willing to reach out her small, wrinkled hand to help us up. It's not just that we read her stories and believe in them, feel seen in them, see the world through them. It's that her stories, in turn, believe in us, believe in our best selves, and address that part of us that had perhaps been hiding all along, but dying to come out and play. What a manifest and many-headed gift Miss Le Guin's body of work has been, continues to be, will go on to be for a very, very long time for this broken world. What a necessity. One of those many gifts is what I'll address to close this out. It is the gift of permission. Because for us newly hatched, just starting out writers with a lot to say, with words and ideas and opinions and, quite frankly, rage pouring out of us and no idea what to do with it all, and so few models of writers who will even admit that this world is indeed a tangled, beautiful disaster. To see a writer who was unafraid to speak truth to power is crucial, a roadmap through the wilderness, because of course, it's not just Earthsea. All of Ursula Le Guin's stories, essays, and poems refuse the easy outs, subvert the simple, crusty tropes we've all grown used to, and push into new ground. They complicate the too often simplified notions of power, spirituality, magic, voice, identity, gender, and race, all while telling marvelous tales of magic and wonder and dragons. And in so doing, they give permission to the rest of us. We can do it too, we realize. There is room in this broken world for our stories, in part because Miss Le Guin made room. And that's one of the greatest gifts an artist can give the world. Ursula Le Guin also wrote my favorite closing sentence of any essay ever. And I'll borrow it here to say goodbye to a woman that I never met, but loved deeply, whose words and stories have been a helping hand, a map through the wilderness, a vessel carrying us out into the far reaches of the galaxy, and whose words and stories will outlive not only her, but thankfully all of us too. Into the spaceship, Granny. Thank you.
Here's Ursula's biographer, Julie Phillips.
The first time I really talked to Ursula,
I came out west and met her in Cannon Beach, where she had a house. And it seemed like everything I'd ever imagined about her. I met her on the edge of the world in a little house in a lonely spot because it was February. And just through the pine trees, the waves were crashing on the sand. And we were there at the uttermost west, sitting in the kitchen table, drinking tea and talking about writing. Only later, when I told her how magical it had seemed to me to have met her in this place at the farthest west, she laughed and said, "Oh, that's such an East Coast view. Why would the West be the end and not the beginning?" So she asked me to be her biographer, and ever since then I've been thinking about the shape of her life story. When you write a biography, you try to give it a beginning, a middle, and an ending, but real lives aren't lived that way. We double back on ourselves, we run into dead ends, we go in circles. Lives don't want to be arranged neatly from A to B, and it's especially hard to write the life of someone who has just told you that what you thought was the end was really the beginning. So how does she begin? As a child, Ursula Kroeber, sitting on her roof in Berkeley, gazing out over San Francisco Bay to the west, seeing the beauty and strangest of that magical place, California, where she was born. You could trace a line on the map of all the places that she lived. I know she thought of her character Ged's life as having a spiral shape as he moved around Earthsea from east to west. She went east and went to Europe and lived in Georgia, where Charles was from. And when she first saw Portland looking out of the window of an airplane, she cried because it was so beautiful and it was going to be her home. Maybe her middle point was home. She had a talent for feeling at home, whether it was in a shabby student hotel in Paris or the house in the Napa Valley that was at the heart of her world. She told me, "I have never lived anywhere I really felt not at home, except for Moscow, Idaho, and even that had redeeming features." She loved Portland, and it's wonderful to see how much Portland loved her. But home wasn't only a physical place for her. She wrote that going home is to be quiet, to be still. Home is where Ged goes when he has done with doing. She wrote that home is the place where you know things are done rightly, done well. She wrote that home is an imaginary place that we make real by dreaming it and by telling its stories. So is home the middle, or the start, or the ending? Once, in the middle of sorting out what seemed to me the paradoxes of her life, I told her I felt like I was writing a narrative that was all middle. It seemed like the model of narrative that she once wrote about, the hoop snake, that creature of Western legend, which puts its tail in its mouth and travels by rolling. The only clue she ever gave me in all our hours of talking about her life to how I should write it was when I said that and she said, "I think you're onto something there." In many ways, the middle point for her was her writing. She wrote about balance in the world, and writing was her own balance point. It was also her gift. A friend recently asked me if Ursula had ever felt the way some women in particular do, that she wasn't entitled to write, that she should sacrifice that part of her inner life to the world's needs. "No," I said, "I don't think she ever felt that. She loved being with her children and with Charles. I used to talk to her on the phone, and she would always end by saying, 'I have to go fix lunch for Charles now.' And she always sounded so pleased when she said it." But that none of that changed her sense that writing was what she had to do. She said her writing was the thing that makes itself through me. It's the particular thing I was sent here to do. I guess at some point I have to come to the ending, but it's not easy to think about something I never wanted to happen. I don't want to have to be here. I don't want to have to write about her ending. I want her to be here, admonishing us and teaching us and showing us with all the power of her imagination how to see from other points of view. In some ways, I want to tell you that this is the beginning. I listen to that amazing speech you just heard, and I think that's the voice of someone who's beginning something. Sometimes I think we're like Odo, the anarchist theorist, in her story, The Day Before the Revolution. Odo is the one who says that great, famous, paradoxical line that is written on her gravestone, to be whole is to be part, true journey is return. As an old woman, Odo hears the sound of the general strike, and she knows then that the change she has always worked for will come after she's gone. And this ending gives me hope that we can move forward on all the paths Ursula showed us, and that we can begin the revolutionary work that she gave us to do. But Ursula wrote other endings too. I think a lot about the ending of her book, The Other Wind, when they break down the wall of stones, the wall that separates the living from the dead, the wall that had to be broken so the dead could be part of the living world, so the dead wouldn't be too far from us and they wouldn't be alone. You know, there are times in the Earthsea books, at some of the endings, when it seems like the world will lose its magic, it seems like all the magic has gone out of the world. And I asked her about that once, and she said no. She said Earthsea's magic will always be there, it will always be refilled and restored. Last week, her last Earthsea story was published. She wrote a couple of last Earthsea books, but she kept coming back to it, and she said she wasn't writing anymore, but she wrote one last Earthsea story. And it tells about Ged coming to the end of his life. He thinks back over his life, and he remembers his book, boat Look Far, that took him all over a sea from east to west. And he has a vision of himself sailing to the true west, where there is only the sea and the sea wind. And maybe we could take his words for her words and give her that ending. We could say of her as she says of him, she would go on this time until she sailed into the other wind. She went forward, onward, the way she had to go. Thank you.
Here's writer China Mieva.
When, as readers, we talk about Ursula Le Guin, we tend to talk not only about the sheer quality, but about the politics of her work, her fury and her sensitivity to issues of race and gender, exploitation and violence, injustice and oppression. And it's quite right that we should do so. Le Guin's incomparable work was inextricable from her commitment to justice and her yearning for social emancipation. But she was never po-faced. And not to mention certain other key qualities that accompanied that passion and that commitment would, of course, be to diminish her. Here, what I want to do is draw attention to her capacity to astonish, including perhaps herself, her curiosity, her generosity, and her sense of humor. Because it would be remiss if, in stressing her importance to us and to literature, we didn't mention how very funny she could be. And I'm going to try and illustrate these other qualities of Le Guin by revealing a literary secret. And we don't generally consider Ursula a writer of horror, but I know that I'm not the only person for whom one of the earliest encountered, strongest, and most influential terrors in fiction is what Daniel mentioned, the shadow. This is the entity of ancient darkness that, through arrogance, Ged inadvertently looses on the world in A Wizard of Earthsea. I cannot describe the breathlessness with which I read and reread its emergence, those horrifying descriptions. Quote, through that bright, misshapen breach clambered something like a clot of black shadow, quick and hideous. A lump of shadow, like a black beast, though it seemed to swell and shrink, and it had no head or face, only a blind, unformed snout without lips or ears or eyes, and it crawled on terrible, taloned paws. For decades, at least as much as the ghosts of M.R. James or the tentacles of Lovecraft, Ursula's shadow has haunted culture and me. this baleful animal emptiness that hounds Ged across the world has hounded me too in my dreams. And a long time ago, I took the opportunity to tell Ursula how powerful an impact that presence has had. In response, she disclosed to me the secret of the shadow. It's a secret that I have carried for years and that I will now reveal. Yes, she said, the shadow. That was inspired by the tardigrade. Now, as many of you obviously know, the tardigrade is a tiny animal, perhaps half a millimeter long. And it's renowned in particular for two things. One is that it is spectacularly resilient. It can go dormant and survive in the cold of space itself. And the other is that it is thoroughly adorable. This is the tardigrade. As you can see, this is a tiny beastie that looks like nothing so much as a many-legged gummy bear, with the highly unusual waddling shuffle that gives it its name, tardigrade meaning slow stepper. This is famously the cutest ambulatory motion in the microscopic kingdom. And it's a source of unending delight to me, and I hope to you, and a delight that sheds light on Ursula's creativity, that Ged's nightmare, the entity of formless terror, the predatory void, the haunt of our childhoods, is born of that micro-cutie, also known as the water bear and the moss piglet. And this secret gnosis that I am sharing with you has a coda, and it's one that's based on a startling case of parallel evolution of inspiration. This is a story of culture, first as high tragedy, and then as cheerful farce. In 2015, I wrote to Ursula in tremendous excitement with news of a new movie called Harbinger Down. This is an amiable, underwhelming piece of science fiction monster schlock set at sea that currently languishes with an aggregated critic score of about 43% on Rotten Tomatoes, not wholly unfairly. And what I said to her then was, it is my duty to inform you that these many years later, others have come up with the idea too. The monsters in Harbinger Down are mutated tardigrades. Now, my patience and affection for B-movies is very great, and I had a very good time watching Harbinger Down, but still, I couldn't in conscience exactly recommend it. The script, for example, includes this exchange. How does whale scientists know how to do makeup? Before I was a whale scientist, I was going to school to study makeup. So the movie, I regretfully warned her, was not terribly good. Ursula's response was immediate. Well, shame on them, she wrote back, for degrading the tardigrade. Thus, the first great tardigradophile in Fantastica kept faith with her own monsters and with their sources and chided the second tardigradophile for letting those monsters down. But this coda, too, has a coda, because her email didn't end there. I have to say, she went on with enthusiasm, the title Harbinger Down is fine, though, somewhere between Jane Austen and the Rabbit Fellow. That latter, of course, being a reference to Watership Down. And the thing is that anyone can laugh at monster movies. It's part of the point. I do it, we all do it. But at a moment when the sneer is becoming the default cultural mode, it takes someone extraordinary to laugh, yes, and yet still, with instant playfulness but thoughtfulness, to dignify such so-called low culture in such a kind and funny way. When I remember Ursula K. Le Guin, yes, I remember the epochally great writer, the poet, the essayist, the teacher, the polymath, the inspirational radical, but I also always remember the person who, having given us a sublime, could still find shreds of that sublime in the ridiculous that came after it. She was a trenchant and a coolly devastating critic who never bit her tongue when she was unimpressed. But Ursula was also someone with the humor and that generosity of spirit to find not just Richard Adams, but Jane Austen, her beloved Jane Austen, in the cheesiest creature feature.
This episode of the Archive Project featured a tribute event to Ursula K. Le Guin, which took place on June 13th, 2018. If you'd like to see the video of the event, go to www.literary-arts-tribute.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.